on the mass psychology and behavior program. My name is Mary Ann Labbitt, and I'm an editor at Public Seminar, which is a website that is affiliated with the New School, but also somewhat independent. In case you're not familiar with it, it kind of provides a two-way portal or window between the academic world and the general public, the public discourse. And so I like to think that we have two missions. One of them is to provide a window onto the ivory tower, as it were, what are academics working on today, what is scholarship doing today, and as well as to provide a forum for academic scholars to comment on contemporary economic, political, and social events. So, you know, we are kind of cursed with living in interesting times, we have pundits opining about this, we have politicians campaigning around it, we have media sensationalizing it, but it's nice to have the longer, more moderate, perhaps, perspective of the folks who have been studying phenomena for 20 years, in some cases 30 years, to have that commentary on developments as well. You know, just for the and we welcome submissions by especially from students who are really interested in submitting to the public seminar website. We welcome submissions to the paper submissions, which is a rare thing in published journal today. We try to bring a diversity of voices, including junior academics, students, as well as staff scholars. So this event has the goal of launching a new vertical at public seminar. So this is our new fascism vertical. It is edited by Chiara Patici and Judith Butler, who joined us here tonight.
Oh, I'm just...
I mean, as a senior editor, senior often meaning like behind the scenes in a wonderful way, right? and I am the hardworking student editor of this vertical. And as you can see from the description, it's a collaboration with the International Consortium of Critical Theory Programs, and it's aiming to bring together not only writing, original writing, and scholarship on fascisms from the past, but also contemporary fascisms, new writing, and populism, but it'll also host things like syllabi, podcasts, calls for paper. It's kind of a clearinghouse of contemporary scholarship on fascism. So with that, let me introduce our panel. In the order in which they will be speaking, they will each give a short presentation, then there will be some brief interchange between them, and then we will open it up to the audience for a Q&A. So Jameson Webster is a part-time faculty member at Eugene Lennon College of Liberal Arts and a psychoanalyst in New York. She has a new book coming out with Columbia Press called Conversion Disorder, and is working on the Cambridge Introduction to Jacques Lacan due next year. Judith Butler is Maxine Elliott Professor in the Department of Comparative Literature and the Program of Critical Theory at the University of California, Berkeley. She is the author of canonical works on gender, subjectivity, performativity, and nonviolence. I will only mention some of her more recent works on politics. There is Notes Towards Performative Theory of Assembly from Park University Press in 2015, and a co-edited volume titled Vulnerability in Resistance from Duke University Press last year. Chiara Patici is Associate Professor of Philosophy at the New School of Social Research. She is the author of a number of works on politics and imagination, including Imaginal Politics, Images Beyond the Imagination, and Beyond the Imaginary from Columbia University Press in 2014, and Imagining Europe, Myth, Memory, and Identity, co-authored with Benoit Chalon from Cambridge University Press in 2013. Please join me in welcoming our panelists.
Physical aptitude for transposing large quantities of energy.
But it's sort of a synonym for hysteria. I'm more interested in the idea of conversion rather than the sort of esteemed hysteria. But in particular, because I think some question of conversion is important for today, especially the sort of hankering for radical change that I hear in our patients, and just a real sort of full sort of demand for that, which I wonder if it was part of this election, especially when you hear people say that they would have voted for Trump even against their own inclination, simply because they promised change, even if it was change for the worse. So that's some way in which I'm trying to think about the term. This is what I want to do, and just to sort of foreshadow that I'm looking at an essay that almost nobody reads called The Taboo on Virginity, which is from 1918. Interestingly enough, some of the terms like the narcissism of minor differences and the question of sexual bondage and the love of leaders come up in that essay, which is called The Taboo on Psychology. There's something important about this very strange view of text that is a kind of background for the mass psychology essay itself. So the first Taboo on Virginity is perhaps one of his strangest papers. A paper where the conundrums of femininity and sexuality meet in a tale that Freud spins about virgin women and the question first through its failures from strange societal biases, male fantasies, general inhibitions and fears, and what he defines as a particular resistance on the part of some women. What's important for me in this paper is the question of a more general landscape of sexual inhibition and resistance that he's wrestling with, which I think fits with a lot of current diagnoses that are about the control of libido, from anorexia to leptomania, from sexual anxieties to the questions of asexuality and misogyny more generally. The Taboo on Virginity is part of what Freud called his trilogy on love, the psychology of love, and what's interesting is that he seems unable to write the female counterpart. He writes a special type of object choice made by men in 1910, and he writes the universal tendency towards debasement in the sphere of love in 1912, and then he can't write this other essay until 1918. Between there, we know some of the most important works take place in Freud, from Totem and Taboo to On Narcissism and Mourning and Melancholia. Then he writes The Taboo on Virginity, and what follows from it is group psychology. So that's the sort of arc in Freud that I'm thinking about that seems punctuated by these reflections on love. The Taboo essay feels completely aberrant from the other two essays on men, which I think are well known. It's really develops the Madonna whore complex and the question of debasement or misogyny within love relationships with men more generally. But the female essay is bananas. I mean, it's all over the place. He has his weird anthropological data that everyone contests. He makes very strange leaps, and he comes to some rather alarming conclusions. One thing that's important to me is the question of inhibition. I think Jules was going to talk about this a little bit, but the question for Freud, at least at this point in time, is actually quite strange. He says that inhibition leads to a kind of anesthesia in the body, an inability to feel, or an inability really to get your drives going anywhere. He says that you can be anesthetic, you can suffer what he's calling a loss of libido without, however, being melancholic. But melancholia is never present without this sort of anesthesia and inhibition, and may in fact be due to a prolonged and excessive relationship to a kind of loss like this in libido life. What's interesting to me at this point is that it's not just a question of mourning in relationship to melancholia, but also a work that he says needs to take place on the level of the loss of libido. How can one mourn the loss of libido? Freud posits the solution, but then doesn't really answer the question. It's very strange, it's very Freud. So let me turn to the Taboo paper briefly. In the interest of time, basically what's coming up for Freud around the question of the virgin, or the ideal of the virgin in a monogamous marriage, is the idea of a one-time sexual act overcoming all of her resistances and inhibitions that have been built up until that point in time when she becomes a sexual being by virtue of the act, not the first word for everyone sexual up until that point in time. But the idea is that this one-time act is supposed to create a lifelong bond between her and her partner. For instance, the demands of virginity in a marriage being the demand that the girl will bring with her no memory of sexual relationship with another, what he calls the logical continuation of direct exclusive possession of women, which forms the essence of monogamy and the extension of this monogamy onto her past. As a diagnosis of monogamy, it's rather brilliant. So this bond that goes to form the ideal of the one-time overcoming of libidinal resistance, Freud says, is in fact an idea of a state of bondage. It's a quote, and he turns to Kraft Ebing at that point for help with the definition. His definition is a person's acquiring an unusually high degree of dependence, a lack of self-reliance in relationship with another person with whom one has a sexual relationship. Freud says that some measure of this sort of self-sacrifice to the other, this dependence, is necessary for the maintenance of civilized marriage and monogamy. We are, by the way, very close here to the kind of passive masochistic attitude of Freud's court to the primal father, which comes up in the mass psychology essay, as well as the hypnotic fascination and surrender to the leader. What Freud then goes on to do is to say, okay, so we have this ideal of virginity and monogamy and marriage. What has it always been? And he turns back to anthropological data at this point and looks at all these studies where many, many things are done in order to divirginize the woman, in fact, not letting it be her partner. And he says, what's going on here? Because it's not, in fact, a desire for possession of the woman, but a desire to get away from her, at which point he comes up with the idea that all women are taboo. He says that men must keep separate, women must be kept separate from the men. They are a challenge to men's self-possession, and the barriers of separation need to be firmly in place in order to aid in a generalized dread of women. Freud's brilliance, of course, emerges once again when he says woman is different from man, forever incomprehensible, strange, apparently hostile. The man is afraid of being weakened by the woman, infected with her femininity, and of showing himself incapable. The effect which coitus has of discharging tensions and causing flaccidity may be the prototype of what the man fears in terms of the realization of the influence which the woman gains over him through sexual intercourse. He then goes on to say, in all this, there is nothing obsolete, nothing which is not still alive among us ourselves. It's a fascinating moment because Freud essentially says that this inability to overcome this dread of women is essentially the condition for marriage and also its point of erosion. And what we have here is a kind of standoff between wanting to possess the woman and not wanting to even get near her, the question of self-possession in general, hers and his. Narcissism of minor differences underlies here what Freud calls the narcissistic rejections of women by men, which he says is so them. So this is the first part of the essay. I think I've made it very digestible. It's a lot less digestible. But it's easy understood. I mean, Freud can do this. He can sort of diagnose the problems in sexual relationships. He can pinpoint a certain kind of weakness in men in relationships to women. And it makes a lot of sense. But then he moves forward. And the way he moves forward is to ask the question about what happens when the resistance is on the side of the women themselves. This is where he always gets into trouble. Freud points out that, you know, we know in psychoanalysis something important about what he calls the earliest allocations of libido. At this point, he goes on to say that the husband then would only always be a substitute. He is, Freud says, never the right man. In this depiction of modern love, then we have a man who wants to be the only man and a woman for whom this man who wants to be the only man is never the right man. There's always another man. There's always the original man, the father. Of course, when Freud says the father only needs to think of the mother, he's not there yet. A woman's reactions, he says, to this never the right man lead Freud to discuss a whole host of archaic feelings aroused by first intercourse or first love. You know, with the usual culprits, the desire for revenge, castration, beheading, and the like. And so, of course, you have this sort of like monstrous castrating woman that Freud says, you know, is the real problem in terms of this resistance. The possessed woman, he says, must exhaust her sadism. Second marriages, he declares, are often better. The archaic reaction of brain, the woman who said it was terrible first, are just terrible whether you want her to be it or are it. Freud, of course, in this is somehow incredibly right and wrong in fascinating ways, as he always is. What I think he is saying is that something must be overcome. There's a certain kind of resistances, there's a certain kind of war between the sexes, but then there's a question of a more archaic resistance. A more archaic resistance that he always discovers when he talks about women and sounds so incredibly misogynistic, but it's always then a question for both sexes. Right? You have to do this displacement from woman back to man, back to woman, to go from father to mother, and you have to build a richer picture, which is many of the sort of post-Freudian psychoanalysts did. What I think he is saying is that what must be overcome by surrendering to some kind of bodily upheaval, some kind of removal of inhibitions that are necessary, must happen in either sex or sexuality itself that prove resistance to the distributions of libido that need to take place. Whether it's moving a static, one-time fixed image into a process, whether it's about the first-time actuality of sexual intercourse moving into something that we might call sensual life, whether it's the removal of expectations linked to the past that bring disappointment into an experience of something new, or whether it's about this feeling of dread moving into a feeling of fellowship. That can be easily said about sort of what Freud's imagining, but what's interesting to me in particular, and I feel so lame because it's so psychoanalytic, is that what saves us is the sexual. If you read Freud carefully in this essay, and especially then moving into the group psychology and analysis of the ego, it really is only the sexual itself that can move us past the vicissitudes of possession, bondage, and hypnotism. This is what we see arise with the question of sexual love at stake in Freud's essay on virginity. How does any of this become sexual and not simply a state of bondage or war between the sexes, is the question that he's asking. In group psychology and analysis of the ego, Freud places sexual satisfaction and the overvaluation characteristic of love in stark opposition to one another. He does this in order to highlight the characteristic of what binds individuals into a mass and also think about what breaks them apart, even if that is simply into the loving couple, the sexual loving couple. Love's overvaluation without sexual desire is linked to sexual bondage and hypnosis since the ego surrenders itself to the object. Hypnosis, like group psychology, uses aim-inhibited impulses, what he calls the affectionate current, or in other words, the lack of sexual satisfaction necessary to the effective tie between leader and follower in order to sustain this impoverishment of the ego and keep inhibitions in check. Freud says in the group psychology essay, two people coming together for the purpose of sexual satisfaction, insofar as they seek solitude, are making a demonstration against the herd instinct, the group feeling. The more they are in love, the more completely they suffice to each other. So he's not advocating that we turn away from the conundrums of love towards unbridled sex. Certainly, he says it's a problem of a sort of tendency in groups to want to throw off their shackles. But in fact, love in itself is not the problem, since love can be a demonstration against the herd instinct. It's asexual love used by leaders that's more the problem. Freud, uncertain as to the future of either groups or sexual monogamy, sort of encounters a kind of urgency to figure out what might be possible in the narrow straits between the demands of object love and sexual desire. He writes, even in an individual who has in other respects become absorbed in a group, the directly sexual impulsions preserve a little bit of his individual activity. If they become too strong, they disintegrate every group formation. In the same way that love for women breaks through group ties of race and national divisions and the social classes and symptoms, it thus produces important effects as a factor in civilization. So at this point, we see that the sexual love of women, or sexual love in general, is essentially asocial. Freud points out that this asociality is also true for neurosis itself, which he points out has disintegrating effects on group bonds. Quote, all the ties that bind people to mystico-religious or philosophico-religious sects and communities are expressions of crooked cures of all kinds of neuroses. I love this because it points to group psychology and the mystico-religious, philosophical-religious ideologies that it produces, right? Are crooked cures for neurosis. He's sort of amazed by the fact that like, what happens in group psychology is that neurosis can disappear altogether, whereas a neurosis is a pulling away from the group and a creation of a personal mythology that is trying to find some solution to the impossibility of sexual relationships.
So sort of what I was finding at this point is if we're looking for three oppositions to group psychology, we essentially have sexual love, or we find sexual love of women, we have neurosis, and we have psychoanalysis, which has to not be a crooked cure. Freud himself ends the group psychology, indicating that neuroses are extraordinarily rich in content, that they embrace all possible relations between the ego and the object. And it's as if at the very end of the essay, he's advocating for us to go into neurosis to find the wealth of possibilities of possible different ties that could exist in the neurotic symptom itself, right? Which otherwise would not exist in the sort of mass psychology that's present at that point in time. One might, of course, remember that the malaise of civilized life is countered by a psychoanalytic cure, which pushes back, he says, against the cost of civilized morality, making psychoanalysis, like the love of women and neurosis more generally, asocial and disintegrating. I want to think of this asocial work as a kind of work at this place or loss of, in the not of one's libido, in order to produce something new, to produce something that doesn't exist in what the world has to offer around us today. My worry, however, and this is probably because I have a hard time thinking as anything but a psychoanalyst, is that I don't know what love, or sexual love or neurosis in reality can do. I think I understand something about what psychoanalysis can do, but it's a one-by-one, very slow thing that I do all day long, and that sort of worries me. But the reason that psychoanalysis makes more sense to me with respect to this is that psychoanalysis has more possibility for finding the solution than it can in the real world, because the analyst is subtracted from the real world. And the analyst knows how to make themselves the object of love without a promise, without an identity, without a body, because the analyst knows how to break language, not make it, so that these lines and urgency can intensify to find its own solution. Because the analyst is the one who can hear the appeal, the elegant articulation of the symptoms, so that we can push back against the contradictions in the appeal to love, kicking back against nihilism, bondage, melancholia, love like consumerism, disappointment, and finally, what I really do think is our biggest enemy, inhibition, since it always leads to violence. And by the way, with all the talk about acting out and disinhibition and all of these things, you know, patients are all really crazy now, or crazier than they used to be, I just don't, it's just not true. I mean, I can have a really acting out patient, and you sort of get this under control, and they have all the old-fashioned inhibitions, deeply, deeply inhibited. So I don't like the rhetoric of disinhibition, and I think that the question of inhibition is important. So looking at these two essays together, I would say that for myself, it's not really a question of first intercourse, or even first marriages, or good marriages, or better illusions, or better collective fictions. Maybe simply a question of first analysis, of what analysis can make possible, the archaic reactions being given a place to exhaust themselves. And these inhibitions for Freud, at least in the way that I'm looking at it in the conversion context, give way and open onto what he calls a somatic preserve, this sort of renewal of some kind of life in the body, and what he calls the inexhaustible reserve at the heart of a conscious life. Perhaps here we have the analyst not just simply as the figure of a midwife, but also the net of the right man. Thank you.
To distill a few points from Freud's mass psychology, you know, it's group psychology, but it is mass psychology, and the analysis of the ego, in order to see whether, despite having been written some 95 years ago, those points still have the power to illuminate forms of libidinal excitement, excitable cruelty in particular, on the right, and how this operates in the election and regime of what we call Trump. My interest is less in a psychopathology of that person, although I think that that's important to do. Some people have already done some important work on that. My interest is rather in the mass formation that invests in someone named Trump, that bears around the name, and that is formed and sustained in relation to the executive power, now to some extent embodied by that person. So the right hand understands the choral character of cruelty, the chant, lock her up, that was and still is periodically at the rallies, directed toward Hillary Clinton, but is actually, I think, directed against nearly any woman. But also the license that allows the policeman to invoke the Trump election to justify his beating of a black man on a street near me, or the Airbnb host who invokes the Trump election to deny renting property to an Asian person, or the many immigration officials now using discretionary power to harass and refuse incoming visitors from various countries, despite the fact that the travel ban remains suspended. And of course, I would add to that the great jubilation that the former Tea Party had at the thought that health care might be denied to everyone. It is a celebration of the market, right? The market is liberated from government, I gather. That must be part of it. But I think there's also sadism that's hard to fathom. What struck me a few days following the election was a scene in a restaurant in which a man was sitting with a woman in a booth blocking her exit from the shared seat and yelling at full throttle, "You will never humiliate me again. That is why I voted for Trump. I voted for Trump, and you will never humiliate me again." Now, I don't know whether he had grounds for being that angry about humiliation, but it was clear that he was physically blocking her way, pushing her back when she sought to move, and that she was frozen with fear and publicly humiliated as some people turned toward the scene, although some did not, treating it as an everyday event, I guess. I summoned up my ancient feminist courage to go stand by the booth and ask for the management, believing momentarily in proprietary authority, to say that I thought she was probably in danger and that some sort of intervention was necessary. But there was a general skepticism that anything could be done, or indeed that anything out of the ordinary was really happening. Isn't that just life as we know it? We know how other outbursts on planes or brawls in parks, a sudden outbreak of rage against minorities and women, but also against intellectuals, feminism, trans people, trans rights, Black Lives Matter, education, the Constitution, the press, and the environment, to name a few. So one question I have is whether these sorts of concerns or these sorts of groups have come to represent a kind of superegoic censorship from which Trump promised to liberate the people. How does a social and political movement for freedom, equality, and justice become transformed into a form of moral censorship, an attack on sexual life, an attack on impulse and freedom, an unfair and prolonged restriction on personal freedom in particular? And to what extent did the phenomenon of Trump license or unleash a rage against moral self-restriction, positive feminism, and sexual harassment law, for instance, as the instrument of a left-wing superego from which liberation was paramount? Although we would be right to claim that feminism is in large part a struggle for freedom, it is, in the current logic, cast as a restraint on freedom. So upon reflection, we can see rather clearly that though we might have thought that Trump's acts of sexual coercion, his avowed contempt for women and for the law, his anti-intellectualism, his racism, his lack of understanding of what the Constitution is or why it might be valuable, would disqualify him in the eyes of the Republic. We did not, I think, some of us, quite see that these were all regarded by his supporters as strong qualifications for the job. So Trump is perhaps the new name for the radical disinhibition of raging and rageful desires and impulses in a scenario in which the left is cast as the agency of inhibition, censorship, shame, and oppression, the cultural superego. For reasons that we will be fathoming for some time to come, he was able to stand for freedom for so many people, or at least enough people, to win the electoral college vote. So one question is, freedom from what? If we expect to use the analysis of fascism, for instance, to understand this phenomenon, we are immediately confronted by a number of problems, one of which is that the executive power in question does not exactly represent law and order. For the mode of governing is quixotic and changeable, and there seems to be no uniformity of will. Indeed, there's a moment in Freud in the Theater of the End where he actually says, there is no unifying will for the end. It's like, oh, Hillary Clinton was right to call it the end. Anyway, some people think he's very clever, he's like changing all the time, like, I'm not clever. But I'm not sure. that would attribute a kind of continuous intention that may well be absent. In some ways, he is more clearly against law than for it, since power is arbitrary. That, too, though alarming beyond belief for many of us, is a source of exhilaration for those who applaud the bravado, even the contempt for the Constitution and constitutional democracy. It may seem odd to Freud under these conditions, but I'm not sure anyone else has ever reflected upon the phenomenon of disinhibition, especially disinhibition in groups, in the way that Freud has. I mean, there are various theories of group psychology, and he cites some of them, and some clearly followed him, but this one, I think, helps us still. So the question, one question is, can it help us understand the parameters of excited and jubilant hatred? In his discussion of Gustave Le Bon on crowds, Freud seeks to take account of what Le Bon calls the invincible power which allows the individual to yield to instincts, sexual drives, but that's the translation problem, to yield to drives which, had been alone, he would perforce have kept under constraint. The individual is less disposed to check himself in an anonymous crowd. Freud is skeptical about whether individuals suddenly acquire new attributes in the midst of a crowd, arguing that what emerges are unconscious impulses that are suddenly less restrained by conscience or by a sense of responsibility. In 1922, at least, his view is that conscience is a matter of social anxiety, wondering what others think, feeling constrained by the judgments of others. In addition to disinhibition, Freud rehearses two other points by Le Bon. The first is contagion, where the suggestion is made that contagious effect within crowds functions like hypnosis, or can be understood to belong to a hypnotic order, to such a degree that the individual sacrifices his own interest for those of the collective. The second is related, and that is suggestibility, whereas Le Bon relies on terms like magnetic attraction to highlight this phenomenon. Freud remarks that those who are under the influence of suggestion, and so still within an extended region of hypnosis, undertake actions with irresistible impetuosity that is increased or made more likely in the case of crowds. So contagion is the crown phenomenon, and suggestibility takes a more heightened form when coupled with contagion. But perhaps most importantly, the crowd is governed by unconscious motives, and those are brought forth by grand gestures, powerful images, exaggerations, and repetitions, saying the same thing over and over. Right? It's a kind of crowd hypnosis. Okay. The crowd expects a tendency toward violence. In Freud's words, it wants to be dominated and suppressed and to fear its master. Precisely because Le Bon does not accept that there's any repressed content breaking through the surface, it becomes Freud's task to rethink how and why disinhibition takes place in the way that it does. Freud disputes the notion that there there might be hereditary grounds for the desire for authority to which a crowd must submit. In this way, herds of animals and groups of people behave the same way according to the bone. The mass is a docile herd. Freud makes clear that the mass can only find a leader if the leader himself is enthralled to a powerful group, at least on animals to do that. But he's saying that as distinct from a human. And if that leader is enthralled to a powerful belief and exhibits his own powerful belief, then, and only then, can he compel the powerful belief of the masses. Freud writes, he must possess a powerful commanding will that the will-less mask breathes in from him. His will becomes their ether, the pure essence that the gods breathe. What Freud does not immediately say, but as later, is that as much as the mass breathes in his will is pumped up by their exhalations. The result of attributing such powers to a leader is the effect of prestige and what Freud describes as precipitating the paralysis of the critical faculty. Later he remarks that within a crowd perceiving someone else with heightened affect evokes a sympathetic response, a form of primitive sympathy or contagion that induces in the perceived the affect perceived. Induces in the perceiver the affect perceived. This compulsion becomes stronger, more heightened the affect, and the affect heightens precisely through the sorts of contagious communications that happen with the crowds. Relying then on the work of William McDougall on the Greek mind, Freud remarks that the most important phenomenon of mass formation is the way in which it stimulates in each individual an exaltation or intensification of emotion, the result of a reciprocal induction of heightened affect. As a consequence, the individual's critical capacities will fall silent. Then again, Freud reiterates McDougall, people protect themselves against the collective diminution of intellectual performance by taking the solving of intellectual tasks away from the mass and reserving it to individuals within the mass. And then Freud corrects the formulation. Qualities are conferred upon the mass that must characterize the individual, and those qualities are the very ones that have been faced by the formation of the mass. So Freud tells us that to some degree the formation of the mass makes us dumb, or rather we become stupid together, relegating the task of thought to someone else, or perhaps to no one, inverting the character of the individual and the mass, preferring our self-loss to the travails of individuation. But another logic of inversion is perhaps even more primary. The heightening of affect correlates with, and I quote, the noticeable reduction of intellectual performance. So when we think of mass formation as an exercise in disinhibition, the mass actually inhibits thought. So where the inhibition of antisocial impulse once reigned, the inhibition of thought now prevails. We've not, it seems, overcome inhibition by becoming absorbed into a mass. That seemed to have been the promise. But rather, inhibition has only shifted its focus and inverted its operation. So why elaborate on a theory of group psychology, mass psychology, that was crafted in the early 1920s in the aftermath of World War I, before the actual rise of fascism and World War II? What use is it for us today? It has the further weakness of being formulated right before the superego is introduced. Even so, we can see in these pages that the superego is definitely on its way. For what is the mechanism by which the disinhibition of cruelty takes place? How do we name it, and how do we describe it? What, for instance, does disinhibition have to do with identification? I think for us in these last weeks and months, it has been difficult as well to find the right language to describe the forms that this disinhibition takes. Although we talk about hatreds that have been unleashed, with the advent of the Trump regime, we do not always understand the mechanism of that unleashing. Does unleashing mean that a desire was always there but simply held in check? Or does the mode of unleashing structure and even partially form the desire, even the rage that emerges? Sometimes we say that Trump has licensed a new wave of misogyny, or that he has made racism permissible. Well, I think those formulations are true, even if I don't quite know what we mean when we say such things. If we accepted a hydraulic model, or one that holds that a quantity of energy is released when the inhibition is lifted, then the impulse is the same whether or not it is inhibited. But it matters how the inhibition is registered, since the emergence of the impulse does not just set aside the inhibiting force, but sometimes wages a frontal attack on the inhibition, looking to become perfectly unchained. The impulse has its way with and against the inhibition, against the critical faculty, not just moral judgments and political evaluations, but the kinds of reflective thought that make both possible what Freud called the critical faculty. And that critical faculty will come to characterize the superego in 1923. So how are we then to understand this within our present political situation? How do we make a case for the critical faculty in times such as these? It would be a good rallying cry. Well, one clear implication of this critique is that safeguarding spaces of reflection on universities is rather important. One can use this argument as well to defend humanities and the arts. If one reads Greek tragedy, it's all about blind rage and destructive consequences that follow when liberated from reflection, impulses convert into action. But perhaps as well, Freud's reflections can tell us something about what the plural use of the critical faculty might look like or what it entails. Although I'd be concerned with disinhibition, it's important to note that identification is the name of a separate chapter in group psychology. The identification with the leader becomes another way to lose the separate boundaries of the self. But also, Freud tells us, mass formation disappears, neurosis for a time. It also allows for a phantasmatic assumption of power in relation to one who has also phantasmatically taken power, even if he has in actuality taken power. One takes on a power that is not one's own to supplement and cover over one's felt sense of frailty. I will never be humiliated again. The leader has to maintain a consistent show of strength, but Trump seems to depart from the norm of authority that Freud had in mind. After all, Trump reveals his sensitivity to criticism, his desire to be loved, his need for approval. He requires the choral amplification of his grandeur by the crowd. He also changes his mind, does not know the law, shamelessly lies and exaggerates, and advertises his double standards as if he's proud of them. And in this person mocks the idea of consistent and strong authority, indeed, suggesting that authority is nothing more than a periodic and arbitrary show of power. Apparently, I've been, of course, raging like many people, but I think it's important to stay calm. I think it's time. Okay. Apparently, those who continue to applaud this behavior appreciate the way in which he departs from the truth, feels bound by a few moral norms, disdains rationality and consistency. He does whatever he wants, and in that way, that embodies the fantasy of being unbound by both law and a truthful representation of reality. I should say law, morality, and a truthful representation of reality. The lie itself is exhilarating, for then he is bound by no one and nothing. His unpredictability should disappoint the need for consistent authority, but the attack on an inconsistent authority is apparently a throw of his own. The issue of identification moves large, for he is above the law, and if we identify with him, then we too are above the law, unconstrained, and an infinite appetite. So the one who is supposed to represent the law attacks the law, and the identification with him animates fantasy, a fantasy to wreck the law and become free of its constraints. This authority does not embody the superego, but rather the attack against it. And the superego? Well, who's that? I'm afraid we have become the superego within the social psychic imaginary. We left useless intellectuals who should be defunded and derided and chased from power. So I do not have the time to argue it, but one reason I believe that an effective alliance should be based on disidentification and perhaps also hanging on to our neuroses, is that it keeps us from becoming taken up by mass formations such as these. And I have a little bit more to say on this in relationship to the ego and the ego, but I'm going to hold those remarks until our conversation. Whatever the left is that now must form will not be exactly like others we have already seen. Perhaps it's a moment to consider the unlikely allies, the police departments that refuse to deport what the LAPD, seriously? And I spent my whole life hating the LAPD. Okay, but here they take a really strong principal stand. The liberal lawyers who decided to go to Yale Law School instead of philosophy and New School, who stay up all night to stop an immigration policy that's overtly discriminatory. The farmers who oppose the deportation of their workers, the Republican city councils and town halls that decry the decimation of the Affordable Health Care Act, the whistleblower in the State Department. Perhaps it's most hopeful not only to stand with those whose views we know, but with those who take us by surprise and make us rethink the contours of alliance itself. We would, of course, retreat. We could retreat and consolidate the left, including only those with whom we feel clear identification and share our goals and aspirations. They are already convinced of everything we also believe. They are solace to us during hard times. I understand how compelling it is to identify only with them. We can name the list of identities that have composed the left, but can we name as easily the principles under which those identities have gathered? In my view, identification cannot always be the basis of alliance. What would it mean to include those with whom we do not readily identify, or to be included by them? For the simple reason that a shared sense of justice, equality, or freedom is radically contravened by the current element. Is identification a sufficient basis for solidarity, or is it time to align with those we never expected to expect? The police who refuse to deport, the immigration officer who refuses to discriminate, the civil servant who refuses to implement the unjust policy of the liberal jurist who wants nothing of leftism, who is seeking to save key provisions of the Constitution, the rabbis whose views on the Middle East are impossible to share, but who object to the Trump administration's travel ban and its clear intent to discriminate against religious minorities. An alliance of those who refuse to comply, to implement, those who actively block or passively resist, will not comprise the usual allies, but those we did not expect to find and who we would be foolish to reject. The massive demonstrations put pressure on legislatures to withdraw their support and overcome their fear, but the very acts of non-compliance happening in disparate localities have the power to undermine the efficacy of executive policy. I know this from Sproul Hall at the University of California at Berkeley. Perhaps you know it's our kind of public area. It's where our demonstrations are. It's where our gatherings are. But it's also where a number of people who have been pushed out of mental health institutions tend to gather and to speak freely. I happen to know, and some of them do appoint themselves president or give themselves the most power, they give orders and no one implements them. But they're there rehearsing a speech act for whatever reason, and it does have significance for them. But it reminds me, Kafka reminds me as well, that if the executive gives an order and no one implements it, that executive loses not only power but legitimacy. Non-compliance is one way of withdrawing consent, and that does not happen all at once. Not just the mass action in which we partially lose our heads and become a little stupid with public happiness, but the disparate and cumulative acts of civil disobedience and non-compliance, the ones that coalesce in unexpected and strengthening ways, constituting something somewhat different from a mass or a group, perhaps the emerging map of a movement. Okay? So that's my little rallying call. We'll go back to further discussion. Thank you.
So I think in the end we did plan it well, everything is unfolding with an unexpected order. Okay. So I would actually begin with some comments on the movement in the text itself, the Freud mass psychology. I have to say when Juliet And we were discussing about what are we going to do now after the election of Trump. And we said we should maybe read some classics and go back and see what we can do. And we said, how about mass psychology? So since I still have my super ego, I did the homework immediately. And then since I always exaggerated with my super ego, I said, well, maybe after Freud, I should go back and read again Canetti, which is what I did. And then I exaggerated, and I read again Freud after reading Canetti. So what I'm trying to do is to put the two texts together try to use Canetti's remarks as a way to illuminate something that is happening in the mass psychology text. Because here I build a little bit on what I've already said, but emphasizing a few other points. So first of all, the text begins with a discussion of Le Bon, but then there is an opening up of questions. There is an opening up. Freud says there are different types of masses. There are the stable, the unstable. There are those which resemble high waves, those which resemble a more quiet sea. And he says, well, we will raise only at the height of chapter 6. He says, we may raise the question of whether masses need a leader, but the question is still open, chapter 6. And then it goes on into the analysis of the ego, so there's this huge part devoted to love. And then suddenly, chapter 10, so relatively late, he says, yes, we do need a leader. Masses do need a leader in order to be formed. This is obviously comes out of the analysis of identification, but there isn't really a big argument. There's a bit of a jump from the analysis of the ego to the analysis of the mass psychology, and the jump is justified by going back to the story of the primitive horde. Mm-hmm. There's a change of language there, because he suddenly starts to speak, instead of a leader, he starts to speak about the all-powerful man. Even in, I've read a translation which is male, right, instead of man, so emphasizing the gender dimension there. And it's strange, because he even says, yes, I know people have criticized me for this reliance. Some said it is just a so story, but still, I think it's a useful story. And he keeps on going on, reiterating the story, just by presenting it as a useful story, right? And you may wonder, what is he doing? There was all this nice opening at the beginning, the different type of masses, and then all of a sudden there's this reductio, which at the end turns out kind of reductio ad penis, which happens in many of Freud texts. But again, it goes to his credit, the fact that there's a movement, right? So we can, the same thing with sexuality, that at the beginning there's the perverse polymorphos, and then somehow there's this reductio taking place. Dora is the same thing. It's this mess. Maybe he recognizes their own sexuality, but then no, she really wanted to marry the guy. That was earlier desire. So there's a movement towards the reductio, but there's also these other elements that it gives us to think about the problem at stake. And surprisingly enough, about all these other elements that he quotes, the only statement where it seems to be certain, it says, the only undoubtable fact is that people have a tendency to imitate the affective state of people close to them. And so this imitative tendency, he says, is the only indisputable fact. And so what I'm going to try to do now is to try to speak up and analyze two forms of mass psychology formation by counterposing two types of incorporations. Okay, so I did a PowerPoint hoping to be brief using the synthetic power of image. So the first one is the incorporation with identification. We have already heard about it. In the case of Trump, it's very synthetically expressed by the slogan of his campaign, "Make America Great Again." What I would like to emphasize is that it's a form of identification and a form of incorporation via identification, which rests
on two presuppositions. On one hand, there is it moves within the dichotomy individual body, collective body. There's nothing in between. And we see it in Freud text, it goes from individual ego psychology to the masses, there's nothing in between. But also sort of metaphysical dualism. In particular, it's clear in the slogan in the reference to America. And we know very well from the rhetoric and the propaganda used that America, in Trump's language, is not the territory of the United States with the people who happen to be here, right? It's this sort of metaphysical entity, spiritual entity, which is white, which is made by those original founding fathers who made it, and blah, blah, blah. Now, by saying make America great again, it automatically instills the idea that there was a greatness which got lost, and that the duty of those who identify, make, right, this is the call to identification, is precisely to go back to those that greatness of the beginning. So this is the typical myth of the origins, that great origins, decadence, and rebirth in the leader that we have seen at stake in past fascist regimes. So there's nothing new in this respect about it. And I think that it's important to emphasize this little word again, because if the slogan had been make America great or make the United States great, it would not have had the same impact that it has had. And it certainly would not have had the same capacity to trigger violence, you spoke about sadism, and disinhibition at the same time. Okay, but so in this sense, the sort of identification reproduces the form of, let's say, identification with the head of the state, right? We see at play in modern forms of political identification from the very beginning. I'm putting this because I would like to emphasize again the fact that it's an understanding of the political process which moves within this individual body, collective body. All the bodies that make up the body of the Leviathan are the same, and they identify themselves as equal in the form of the leader. So there is a repetition of going on there. In the case of Trump, of course, the emphasis on the greatness takes a whole phallic language that is repeated over and over again, but there's always the same vertical dimension that is present. But there's also something new, which I think is an attempt to respond to your question, identification going together with disinhibition, in the sense that he also really embodies not simply the incorporation inside the political body with the leader presented as this big father-like figure, but it's more the ethos of the corporation, right? The Trump Tower is the symbol of the corporate power. So in the word incorporation, I think we should also hear the word corporation, which is also, as a pendant, as the idea of the competition, right? As the idea of we live in a globalizing world, people are trying to steal our job, we have to be good entrepreneurs, we have to be good competitors, and what better than a baseball hat to convey like this spirit of competition. I always say when I moved to the United States and suddenly nobody was in the street and I said, what's going on? They told me it's Super Bowl. I'm like, what is that? And they told me, welcome to America. It was the answer. So here is the I think it's very important where the message is conveyed. You can also notice the dressing is very casual, it's not formal. And I think it's precisely this that makes the process of identification that, as Freud emphasized in the text, per se brings us back to our very early stage of the psyche, right? So it's regressive, right? But also, at the same time, with this, and as regressive, it may trigger or archaic fantasies of protection by the big father who's going to beat those nasty people who are trying to steal our jobs. But at the same time, there is also the attempt to present himself as one of us, right? So he has, metaphor of the good coach, the coach of the team, who's the, at the same time the leader, but also one of us. And I think this works as a way to combine the mechanism of identification with the disinhibition, right? So that's probably, I'm trying to, again, here, think together. But I think there's something there with the combination of the two processes, identification plus disinhibition, which is nicely emphasized by this image of the coach, the leader of the baseball team coach. Okay, so having talked about this, this is, again, it's on one hand there's something new because there's this emphasis on the ethics of the corporation, which I think is the neoliberal version of the fascist leader. But I think there's also something that is, we have already seen it, and we can really use some of Freud's insights in order to understand this form of incorporation via identification with the leader. So I've been trying to look at this from the point of view of the process of incorporation more in general, and think of whether is it possible to actually think of processes of incorporation that do not presuppose the identification. And that's where Judith left, and for the time that is left for me, I would just like to try to expand and elaborate on this. Okay, so I did this beginning within the context of an alternative form of ontology, which doesn't move within the same metaphysical dualism and doesn't move within the same dichotomy between individual and the collective. And while doing so, I've used the ontology of the trans-individual, which is a term that Balibar proposed when reading Spinoza's Ethics and coming to the conclusion that you cannot read Spinoza's Ethics with the dichotomy individual versus collectivity in mind. And his argument for saying so is that actually if we take Spinoza's ontology seriously, then every individual is properly speaking a trans-individual because we are constantly constituted in our body by processes of imitation and disassociation that happens both at the intra-individual level and the inter-individual level and at the super-individual level. Okay, if you're lost here, it's fine. I have a more simple way to illustrate this. We can talk about, you know, the ontological monism, the beyond individual versus collectivity dichotomy, bodies as a process, or we can also talk about our bodies, which as processes constantly incorporate individuals and are made and unmade by them. By eating, drinking, sweating, or even breathing. Think of all the exchanges that constantly happen in our body as we move in space, as we eat, as we perform even the most basic functions. Now, what would it mean to think of mass psychology with this ontology in mind? Here, with a bit of a jump and following on this attempt really to think of forms of incorporation that happens on a larger scale than individual bodies, breathing and eating. But they do not go through the identification with the same. So what came to my mind is obviously, also because that's what I'm working on, is the process of mass incorporation, literally
without identification, that constantly happens when migrants cross borders. Mm. And the masses here are pretty huge. This is 2016, but obviously this is because numbers changes, and also nobody really has good numbers because people who, no matter how many walls are built, people who actually manages to cross borders without proper documents are a lot. Yet, as we also know, there are constantly attempts to identify people. So I can't open this website, but this is a website of the United Nations Agency for the Refugee, which tries to categorize them according to their nationality. Mm. Now, for those who have worked and seen how this process of classification happens, it's pretty clear that it's very vague, to say the least. First of all, it's very difficult on the sea to identify people. It's very difficult to know who we're actually dealing with. Most of the time, migrants come in rubber boats, which are filled with people of very different nationalities. And migrants are also trained in techniques. They have techniques to try to resist attempt at identification. For instance, just from the forging of documents to the burning of fingerprints, which is particularly painful in Europe because as a consequence of the Dublin regulation, migrants have to remain in the first country where they arrive, which most of the time means Italy or Greece, and most of the time they actually want to go to richer countries. So in order not to be sent back to Italy and Greece, they burn their fingerprints, so they build alternative identity. Okay, so all this to say that notwithstanding all attempts to actually block them, there is a process of movement, right, and a process of incorporation, because European countries are constantly incorporating within themselves these human masses. And human masses which do not stop. There's nothing so far, notwithstanding all the rules, all the bans, all the regulations that has proved capable to stopping this movement, which is really impressive if you consider. So, trying to make sense of this process of incorporation, I've been wondering, if instead of doing what Freud does, because Freud comes to this reductive closure when, as an example, and quite arbitrarily, it says, let us now talk about the army and the church, right? As example, paradigmatic example of mass formation. So it begins with the most stable group you can imagine, particularly because at the time, the army had just become, in Europe, had just become mandatory, so there's a general conscription in most European states, so people actually had to be in the army, otherwise they would be in prison, right? So I started to think, how about thinking of mass ecology by taking the opposite starting point? So instead of beginning with stability, the most stable masses, let's try to begin with movement, right? And indeed, we can really say that if one thing we can say about this strange thing, which are human beings, is that they've always been migrating. One way to convey this is through Nietzsche's well-known formula that human beings is the not yet festgestelltestia, by which it means the animal which is always not yet adapted. And the fish dies out of the water, human beings have been moving on Earth since they've actually appeared there. And so much so that
It's not an exaggeration. This is a map of the movement of the so-called Homo sapiens, so early humanity. It's not an exaggeration to say that at the beginning was the movement, right? If we have to take a beginning, why the church and the army, right? Let's take another alternative road. And so to come to the Canetti text, which has inspired me more than I could do justice throughout this thinking, what he distinguishes, taking up a lot of Freudian insights, but expanding them, is between actually two types of crowds. One which he calls the open crowd, and then what he calls the closed crowd. So his starting point is that the reason why people gather into crowds is because there's a special pleasure, there's an affective discharge that comes from the overcoming of the fear of touch. People get into crowds because they imitate, so it goes back to Freud's fundamental unquestionable fact, right, that we tend to imitate people, and he says the movement of bodies itself, right, hence the example of the migrant, people moving their body in a certain way generate imitative effect. We have all seen it. If you walk in the street and you suddenly start to look up, somebody will do the same, and then potentially this can grow. Or another example is, of course, is laughter, or just the movement of bodies. There's a dynamic in the migration that is triggered by just the movement of bodies across borders, which calls for more movement, and so movement brings in more movement within itself. Now, is Canetti's distinction between these two types of crowds useful? I think so. I think that we can actually recover some of the early insight inside of the mass psychology about this tendency of human beings to imitate the others, and we can extend it in order to conceptualize not just the closed form of masses that Freud speaks about, the army and the church, which is based on boundaries, which is based on the repetition of the same. We have seen what it means, always the same, repeated over and over again. With open crowds, of which Canetti says not only they are generated by movement, but they're also living off movement. The moment when an open crowd closes itself, then it dissipates. And so it constantly needs this generation. Now, is this a way to resist identification? This is a cartoon which I've used a lot, and I think it tells us something about the way in which, by resisting the identification, by resisting this logic of the sameness, migrants are also at the same time resisting the logic of the sovereign state, which I think it's largely the logic of sameness, is the logic of identifying as equal in sameness. We're all equal as a part of the same political body because we internalize a certain image of the leader. Now, when you say, where are you from? Earth? Is that a way to identify? I've asked myself, and a question I have for you, is that a way to identify yourself as something, or is it just a way to resist identification? I very much hope for the second option. Thank you.
First of all, I thought these were all great and very different, very, very interesting.
maybe this is a question for Jameson, or maybe it's a question just to pose. There's a point in this work where Freud talks about the church and the army, which of course gets taken up later by Althusser. And he says there's no room for women as sexual objects in either institution. He also claims that that what holds those institutions together, what holds the masses together, depends in part on the absence of women as a sexual object. And then he says that direct sexual tendencies preserve a measure of personal activation, even for the individual who otherwise disappears in the mass. Right? So something about sexual desire more broadly differentiates and doesn't allow for full absorption into the mass. And then claims that when sexual tendencies become too powerful, they subvert any kind of mass formation. And I think this goes along with what you were laying out for us. I think but there's one point where he says that it's the love of women that breaks through the mass attachments of race, national segregation, and social class. And that seems to individuate us or keep us from being absorbed into those sociological notions. But homosexual love tolerates mass attachments much better. Right? And I'm wondering why. What is he trying to say here? Even when it surfaces as an uninhibited sexual tendency, a remarkable fact elucidating which may well take us far. I would understand it if it were the Eve Krasovsky Sedgwick thesis that a certain kind of sociality, that is to say, the inhibition without the radical repression of homosexuality produces a certain kind of homosocial order in the church and in the army. But he's actually saying that even when homosexual love becomes uninhibited, it still is oddly compatible with mass formation and can tolerate it. I don't have the dream with me. So I was trying to mark that and ask what we think is going on there. And is there something different from the sexual tendency that individuates if it is heterosexual and the sexual tendency that individuates if it is homosexual? Using these words from the 1920s. Okay. But there's also sort of two other remarks here, which is that it's not just that becoming sexual tends to move us out of mass formation, but being neurotic actually also diminishes the possibility of being absorbed into a mass formation. And in particular, obsessional neurosis, because obsessional neurotics are always afraid that something bad is going to happen. They're aware that it might be something bad or that it could come from the outside world, and they're always checking. They check, they double check, they go back and double check again, and they're always checking out the check. Right? They represent the check. And that's kind of great. So for those of you who are wondering what you can do during the times of emerging fascism, if you are an obsessional neurotic, you are already doing your part. It's a good joke. I'm more serious than that, but I'm also that funny. Okay. So there's the obsessional neurotic who's helpful, but also the explicitly sexual being, but I'm afraid it's going to be only the sexual being. I don't know if it's the sexualized woman. Is it a woman's desire? Is it a gay male desire? Or is it just male heterosexual desire that's functioning in this way? Maybe you can help.
I'm
not
sort of laughing. Tiara's named and handling is to take her dancing. So I think that's what's going on in this movement question. It's a tricky point, actually. I X'd out a lot of what I had written around the question of does it asocial love for women, sexual love for women.
Mm-hmm.
I think you have to read Freud against himself at these moments. And you have to see what he's right about and what he's wrong about and try to bring it forward. So it's an important moment when he says that women are excluded from the group. And there's something about the threat that women pose to it that the group constitutes away from it. And this is why the taboo on virginity paper is important, because it really comes up with the threat of women and the exclusion of women is necessary for whatever the tries. Do you want to read it as a question of sameness, this question of identification that we're all asking? Like, you get amongst like-minded people, and then you other someone else, and their exclusion is what constitutes the group. Do you want to do it as aimed, inhibited sexual impulses, which, you know, create a bond, Freud says, between what he calls brothers, right, as opposed to the ones that have an aim, you know, in relationship to other people or in relationship to an object, in which case you're pulled away from the group and you figure out what these two people are going to do with loving one another sexually. And, you know, one way that Lacan, for example, dealt with this question is he said it's heterosexual love is just simply hetero. Not in the sense of heterosexual, but love for what's different. So I think that's important. At the same time, I kind of want to hold on to something about the question of women because of this election.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't, you know, I think that that's what we have to resolve.
Can I because so when we talk about sadism, the question of women, I think, also brings in another dimension, which is sadomasochism in the picture, in the sense that the most puzzling thing is why so many women avoided for charm, right? We were teaching this class on gender and domination. A lot of, and then a new school, living in New York and being at a new school, you get kind of twice as a lady, and you start thinking that it's not going to happen, that it could never happen. But then by teaching this class, it was really the only moment where we would be teaching this class and say, women could never vote for Trump, and then students bring massive examples of women's movement wearing a t-shirt, grab me from the pussy. And they're like, okay, so maybe this can happen, right? So there's something we discuss in the context of the class, the role of sadomasochism, and a student, really a student, by commenting on a Freud paper, wrote this little essay for Public Seminar, which is called A Child is Being Beaten, literally predicting the election of Trump. And when I read it, I thought, she's brilliant, but she's so off. I mean, it's not going to happen. Right? So I was thinking that was not going to happen. So I wonder whether we should also, along with sadism and disinhibition, also not speak about sadomasochism, and then what kind of psychological mechanism would be at play. And then the other question I had was on the joke, on the... but not joke, this comes out of Freud text, like if neurosis disappear in group psychology, right, all of a sudden, then can we think of neurosis as being a way to resist the temptation of identification happening in group psychology? On one hand, we may want to push that, but on the other, we also wonder whether the relationship works in both directions. Maybe group psychology cures neurosis, but maybe neurosis does not cure group psychology, particularly when it happens as an identification. So maybe that's something to think about. Having read Kanicki, which is now present on my mind, they say group psychology makes neurosis disappear because of touch.
Because in the crowd you're constantly touching yourself, and that is making me very erotic.
Right.
And you would not be the only one. Constantly touching.
Yeah.
The question is, I don't know whether you have an answer to the sadomasochism, but I think it's important.
We
maybe I'll just add to Kiara's question, is the question that I walked away with, and maybe it is what you're asking about the benefits of obsessional neurosis, is about inhibition. And I heard that in what you were talking about, I think it's what you're saying when you're saying, you know, go into the mass and touch each other, which everyone's going to go wash their hands now. But my patients are so inhibited. You know, there's all this talk about millennials and they're entitled and they're arrogant and they don't do what they're supposed to do and they just, you know, they're so inhibited. And I don't know what's going on. I mean, you know, it leaves us vulnerable to the kind of disinhibition that you're saying is part of the Trump administration.
Do you mind if we open up the questions?
But I'm curious about the mother as a site of the failure for identification, whether that's concerning the breast or concerning female castration, the sort of failure to recognize that the mother is neither, doesn't have a penis at all, like it's a different form of genitalia. So there's a failure of identification on the site of the mother. My question is, what do you think about that? Where do you think the mother comes into play? And is it a potentially radical position to take? Or is it, does it complicate and make messy the idea of like a politics of disidentification?
Freud talks about the archaic reaction and the difficulty of tolerating any substitute whatsoever. It is a question of the mother at that point. He doesn't realize it, but it is. And everything that he'll ever go on to say about the question of the fixation of libido is always about the first object. I can't read this forward except for to say that there is something about psychoanalytic work which takes a long time to get there. Exhaust this archaic reaction. I mean, this is what you let patients do, and they treat you terribly. What do you do? I get beat up all day long. And then they're free to do something else. But how, I don't know what political form it's going to take. I don't know if you have ideas about that. I mean, it's part of the lock her up.
I actually think there are a number of issues here, and one of them does have to do with the reconstruction of paternal authority, which we are seeing even if the father is mad, even if the father is out of control, even if the father is inconsistent. It's not an idealized father. In some ways a de-idealized father. It was easier to identify there in a simple sense of identification because he doesn't read, he doesn't know, and you know, maybe there were gas chambers, you know, under the Nazi regime.
Holocaust centers.
No, I mean, you know, it's part of an uneducated, it's like making the uneducated available. And you know, we knew there was massive revulsion and hatred against Obama, but I guess I didn't feel it viscerally until I understood everything, the anti-intellectualism, the racism, the elegance, you know, the actual physical elegance of the man, all of which, you know, the education, all of which was just apparently appalling. So I actually think, you know, and what the threat of Hillary is, and what was she thought by presenting herself as a mother who cared about her daughter and cared about her own father, and why she thought that would work was perhaps very unpsychoanalytic of her. Right? Because most of the successful women in politics, you know, they make that division really, really quite clear. But that was almost an invitation to a kind of intense misogynist rejection of revulsion. So yeah, we have to keep the issue of women, you know, quite central here. But I also think Freud goes on to, you know, talk about an authority who cannot be attacked. You know, for instance, in civilization and its discontents, and he talks about, you know, what is guilt, what is the kind of identification that precipitates guilt. And he says one takes in the unattackable authority, right, into the self. One takes the unattackable authority into the self. And in fact, one attacks it there. Almost like hauling it into a closet, flogging away after that closet happens to yourself. The question is, what allows for the breakup of that kind of very severe capitulation to authority, refusal to attack, refusal to criticize? And part of it is the fear of the loss of love, and also Trump does embody that, the fear of the loss of love. At least that's one thing Freud says in Civilization, is discontent about what is involved in that. But making the authority eligible for attack would actually involve finding one's own proper rage. It wouldn't be to stand against rage, but finding a kind of proper rage that could have a different political form. And I do think that I would tend to understand disinhibition and disidentification might actually open that to some degree.
So Obama was too elegant. He didn't, I mean, this was the criticism, right? Just that he didn't show enough
affect. Well, maybe. I don't know. I think there might be something to be said about that. But I think there was a revulsion at the idea that a dead black man stood for the United States of America, and there was absolute revulsion for the idea that some woman might stand for the United States of America. And this is the revenge of the white male, but it's also the permanently aggrieved and bombastic and self-augmenting white male. It's the, you know, it's not some kind of and it's very, very different, you know. But in any case, I do think that you know, just as I think sadomasochism was a sexual practice is a bad thing, but I think sadism and masochism at the political level that we see it is a bad thing, and I would not make that distinction. And a lot of that has to do with what's coercive and what's consensual. We could have those debates for a long time. But it makes it hard to talk about sadomasochism in a simple way. But I also, I guess, would say that a certain kind of structuring of rage, so that it's not sudden. Disinhibition or wild and reckless disinhibition, right? But perfect rage and corrected. And I also just want to say, Chiara, that I appreciated your bringing in both the Spinoza via Bolivar and the Canetti, because I think it is also true that we have to include that distinction between the individual and the group,
right,
in order to understand how that might even begin to work.
I was really using that dichotomy in the technical sense of the term. So thinking beyond the dichotomy, the dichotomy is not simply a conceptual couple, but it's a conceptual couple that is considered to be exhaustive, right? So it has to be either the individual body or the collective body, right?
Yes.
So, and the attempt, the move to the trans individual is to say, what happens if we go outside of, we dismantle the dichotomy and trying to consider this process outside of it. Yeah, I just wanted to add to the mother question. I didn't speak about it also for the question of time, but I think there's something in the idea of the corporation that is actually kind of maternal. It's not just have a quick. I mean, this is the quickest way I have to show what I mean. If you have a brief look at this.
It's heartbreaking to watch someone bite the hand that feeds them.
Okay, this is the video of a series of called The Corporation, okay?
Spiga Biotech is a generous mother.
He's the generous mother,
it
right?
Will feed you.
He will feed you.
Protect
Russia.
In exchange, it only asks for hard work and loyalty.
So I mean, we may one may want to. Funny enough, this was announced as forthcoming in November. So each time I saw the advertisement on the metro, I thought, I hope that's not the case. But there's something really uncanny, and it is the idea of being the moment you're part of the corporation, it also has this function, and I think part of Trump rhetoric of going to the factory and telling to people, I'm going to prevent your job from going to away to Mexico. I'll be there. I'll be feeding you. So I think it's this is what I'm still trying to think. So I hope we can think about this together. But I do think that there is something new here, which is not simply the paternal figure, but perhaps even beyond voice, but also some sort of a maternal a feeding mother, which plays a role.
A tax offender?
Right.
Well, also the idea that with Trump, at least, that he's gonna go after the people who have restricted things and then redistribute the resources. I mean, that's the
next question is here.
Hi.
Hey.
Hello.
Nice to see you.
My pleasure. Thanks to everybody. I thought that this might be stupid, but I thought I've been very interested in this in the ontological suggestion that you made, and I thought I'd connect that real quick and ask a question regarding the impact that actually has. Because it seems to me that if you read Spinoza, I mean, I don't want to like bring up the like huge Spinoza discussion, right? But it's there's a real question, I think, whether Spinoza is actually a monist or not, and that is in the sense that there's this constitutive essential difference going on between the total infinity and its modal incursions. That cannot be easily negotiated because it's always both,
right.
And you can never tell, is it God or is it just a mode, right? And there's always a failure in the negotiation going on somehow, that is not sufficiently explained, and then this comes up, blah blah blah. But I thought it's very interesting to me that in all of your talks, this the rhetoric of restriction and de-restriction. Disinhibition, inhibition, identification, disidentification, these kinds of things, which are questions of quanta, right? How much play a role. And it seemed to me that it's very interesting that it's coming together in the ontological suggestion, because it seems to me that it's not only a question of starting from movement. But there is a problem of this negotiation, of the overlapping of the individual and the collective, because you're always both, right? It's always like as though you were like crossing your eyes while watching. So I wanted to suggest and float the question to you whether that doesn't mean that that the whole that the whole terminology that has been used must be, could be adjusted, or that there seems to be a need to an adjustment in order to account for this, for longing to renegotiate this indeterminacy.
You know, there hasn't been time to kind of do this properly, and I think you've heard of the, but it's great because we're exfoliating all kinds of possibilities in general world pursuit. But as you know, I mean, at least in Freud's early accounts of identification, when he talks about what happens in melancholia, it's the vestige of the lost object of catharsis, which is incorporated. So that makes Kiara's point in a way that identification is always the trace of the lost loved one in the ego, and that becomes explicit in the ego in the end. So that even when I talk about an I or an ego that differentiates me, I'm talking about something that is already carrying a legacy of lost loves, or what he calls a precipitant. So, you know, there's a breakdown of the I and the other, or there's a relational problem that, and a problem of loss that's already there in the crust of the ego. And so we might say that identification doesn't presuppose an individual and a group. It actually is the site where others become reconstituted as part of the self. And the self is also clearly becoming that for others. So the notion of incorporation is actually a broadly, I think it traverses both categories, and necessarily so. Mm-hmm. What does interest me, though, is that at least in the later work, is where the death drive really enters. We haven't talked about that. Yeah. And there it seems to me that aggression becomes attributed to a death drive, which is not the same as using the Oedipal scene as the way to understand aggression and desire. You know, kill your father, sleep with your mother. You know, that's the framework in which we understand this. But I think actually, if the death drive is taken seriously, there's an aggression that precedes the Oedipal scene. And in fact, it does, because, as we know, his parents tried to do away with him on that on the side of that hill. You know, they had him taken up his own pot, niche, and they really intended to have him exposed to the sun and die. So there's an infanticidal wish. Mm-hmm. So we can't even say infanticide is first. Mm-hmm. Like, there's murderousness that I think maybe gives us some sense of what the death drive is. And it's also why I think the fear of that destructiveness is handled both through inhibition and forms of identification. And so if we take both of those terms as ways of containing it, on the one hand, we applaud that morally, and we lament that there is no check over there. There's no restraint over there. On the other hand, we actually need that rage, and we need that disidentification. We need that to be opened up so that we're not shut down and become unfeeling and become insensate, right? And become unable to respond. And precisely because that, whatever that is, it also, on one hand, it may, when we understand it as antisocial, on the other hand, rage is also subject to the logic of contagion and suggestibility. So it's also part of group formation. You know, we can't be fully antisocial unless we want to understand it, you know, in some highly complicated way. And I guess the last thing I would just say is that you know, thinking more about disidentification, I'm mindful of Jose Munoz's work and how productive that's been for queer theory. And then I'm thinking as well as the refusal to be identified,
right.
The refusal to identify oneself and how important that is in,
right.
in the face of police power, surveillance power.
Where are you from?
Yes, well, it's what Foucault always said about identity. He said, you know, it's the police who ask that question. It's a good reason to refuse the question.
If we can just very briefly on the monism, I think I'm using here, without going into the relation between Sassas and what, just as opposed to dualism. I do think that the insistence on America as opposed to the United States, if the slogan had been make the United States great, if that had a reference to, it would have been the season body which happened to be here now, and that's clearly not the white America, this mythical nation that the alt-right movement and Trump has in mind. So I think there is a kind of metaphysical dualism there, which I'm trying to look beyond. Right? So the experiment here is what happens if we take a different ontological perspective. And it also means if we take the trans-individual seriously, I'm trying to do it, like in individual bodies, and we eat, we do things with our bodies, but also more in general, it also means primarily not thinking in terms you are both. Right? It means that there is no alternative, individual or collective.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It means thinking about the social outside of that alternative. It means thinking of yourself or your body as a process, right? As a process that is really a trans-individual in nature. You didn't choose to be there, you're the result of somebody else's choice that's super-individual, you're constantly in inter-individual relationship that affect your body, but also you're constantly assimilating infra-individuals that make and make your body. And what would that even mean? That's just the beginning of my new project, but what would that mean? To really take the ontology of the trans individual seriously as the priest to think about mass ecology. I think I'm not yet there, but any suggestion is welcome.
There's a question here.
For many, many years, we've been talking about the maternal authority as decreasing, or the name of the father is not. It's work anymore. So, I think I like what you said about the again, about the sadism, because I think we are talking not about identity, burning your fingerprints or your passport is identity. We are talking about identification, which is what he talks on chapter 7 in the psychology, right? With the unary trait. Is that a translation in English? The unary
yes.
Trait? Yes?
Yeah.
So we are talking about this trait that is not working. So if the woman there was not identified as a mother, as a grandmother, as a woman who has been betrayed by her husband, but she was a kind of a block that could serve as identification as this litter, it could have been a woman. It doesn't matter. I love the idea of the again. Again is the words that 3 years old say when we do something funny with them, they say, again, again. This kind of jouissance of 3 years old. So, and this guy was able to do that with his hand, hypnotizing us all the time, and with the again, again. We are back to a 3 years old, pre-Oedipus, but Judith said, asking for a identification, a primary identification. That's, I don't know, I would like to bring this idea. No.
I'm always telling Kiara, in another version of this talk, she has two kinds of identifications that she sets up, and it is something, I mean, I wanted to talk about it, but constraints of it, there's different kinds of identification in Freud. It's not just identification or disidentification, but the identification with the trait, or with the partial
trait,
or with the symptom, or with the locking of the symptom, as opposed to the block.
Yes.
I think is incredibly important. I mean, you know, the different elements that are kind of being picked up here, I think should be put in conversation with that gradation of difference in this text.
But I would just add that the three-year-old is again and again is one thing, but the destroying the piano again and again at age three, which I've also witnessed.
Yes.
You know, I mean, there's again and again of destructiveness. You know, and repetition works in the service of certain kinds of pleasurable satisfactions, but there's a repetition that belongs to the death drive that I think is without satisfaction in the same sense.
Yes.
And that has almost a mechanical and infinite quality. So we need to, you know, think about that again and again, not merely in terms of, I don't know, I don't know if it's just le jouissance or whether we also need to think about the acceptation of cruelty as having a different kind of...
Also because it goes with the greatness. It's not just make it a game. It's make America great again. So there's also this quantification going on, which is combined with the mere repetition.
Yes.
And which brings with it the fantasy of the origins. Like there is an origin. It clothes this mythical entity, this America, with the father appeal of some original moment, right? That you want to bring back again.
Yes.
So it's not simply an again, it's an again of the origin, of the greatness that was there before.
Yes. But I mean, we're seeing now that part of what that greatness is about bombing Syria, like our government opposes chemical weapons as well as it should, and its way of expressing that, and the death of civilians by chemical weapons is to bomb and kill more civilians.
Yeah.
Right. So. At a certain point, we really have to handle we have to think about the destructive character. And you see, I don't think that's a quanta.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think we're just talking about energy then. I think drive is a different economy than energy.
Yeah.
And the repetition of that drive, it's not just augmentation. It's a different relationship to destructiveness.
Right.
Heightened destructivity, which is not,
I'm going to group the next three questions because we're running low on time. First is over here.
Yeah, hi. I think my question, Kiara, you just touched it a little bit, but I was wondering, since nostalgia keeps on coming up, especially in the phrasing of the campaign, and this link between nostalgia and violence, where I'm wondering if in the Freudian corpus he makes it explicit, or whether the panel can make it more explicit, this link between nostalgia and violence in like the development of the psyche, and how the conditions for which that could be exploited by some propaganda or campaign like the Make America Great Again campaign. And I think by, you know, is it that like primordial metaphysical origins linked with the father, or like where is this link between nostalgia and violence in psychoanalytic development?
Next question on the right.
Thanks, everyone. All right, so a lot of the themes I've been speculating actually came up in our chat class yesterday. So we were discussing the incredible text that everyone should read right now, Klaus Taborite's Male Fantasies, where he sort of brings Foucault and Freud together, really, principally, to bear on all these questions about sort of military regimentation. Of course, right. It's these questions that you bring up, Judith, around sadomasochistic cruelty that, you know, are
generated in the army, right, in army training, and that at certain points almost become explicitly sexual, right? There's, you know, there's this point where Togolite refers to the kind of almost orgasmic ecstasy of the superior officer as he makes the rookie kind of faint, and so on. Right, so this is highly regimented. I mean, of course, we're not unregimented. It's like, you know, Trump is unregimented compared to this highly regimented fascist scene. But I just wonder if there's some of the themes that are circulating in your conversation today that are really, and also the distinction between the hard and rigid body that is developed in the body of a warrior and in the body of the army. Collectively, so this question of kind of trans-individuality is also a work there that's being specifically generated by these regimented military practices. So I'm just sort of, I mean, I suppose the question is to sort of throw this text out there about a sort of maybe older fascist form, and of course, but one that of course is still there in a kind of, you know, we've got this very sort of, you know, 3-year-old sort of baby-eared kind of character, you know, capricious.
And they have to ask you to leave it there. There's a lot of response. Thank you so much. And one last question.
Yes. Chiara, I wanted to ask more about mobility and disidentification and perhaps bring out a tension in that, which we heard maybe when Jameson mentioned how people might want change for the sake of change. So on what level do you think an emphasis on mobility could be effective? Is it an image of mobility? I'm wearing this watch now that's sort of a super ego that tracks how many steps I take every day, so that would seem to be a figure of super egoic mobility, and I would counter that with the ideal of free association in psychoanalysis as a possibility of a different kind.
I would rather say the opposite. I mean, the moment you want to track your movement, and it's precisely the moment when this somehow an attempt to control the process. No, the idea of mobility is the taking seriously the idea that individuals are not given once for all, but they're a constant process, and there are processes that happen at the different levels. What this would mean in political terms, I think we haven't done much work in the future. With regards to the nostalgia and violence question, I think it's the connection is precisely in the gap that is generated by the reference to America as opposed to those who are here. Because by referring to the greatness which you want to make happen again, you're implicitly suggesting that there are those who do not fit that description who are responsible for violence. So maybe we should also, when we speak about violence, we should also speak about the fact that it's the violence directed against the other, which are the professional politicians, which are the illegal immigrants, the Chinese working in our jobs. So the xenophobic moment, the violence against the other, is triggered by this reference to a mythical America, which obviously has racial connotation of whiteness. So that's how I would adjust.
Can I address Emma for a moment?
Yeah.
Hi, Emma. I know this book, the Klaus Teller book, but what I think he does is he expands the libidinal reading of Freud. In other words, he takes the part of psychoanalysis he takes, he continues to understand libido as the one and only drive. And I think that sadism, destructiveness, torture, they're rejoiced in, they're part of a libidinal satisfaction, and that's the perversity and the discomforting, you know, aspect of that book. But I actually think he doesn't take the Freud and the Death Drive seriously, which has a much more uncertain relationship to Eros. I mean, sometimes Freud will say at the end of Civilization and its Discontents, he says, well, we can hope for Eros because destructiveness is breaking all the communal ties. At the end of his discussion with Einstein, we can hope for self-restraint. Which is different from Eros. At other times, there's a sexual trend that's in the service of the death drive, and at other times, there's a death drive in the service of the sexual trend, and there's a kind of balancing act, you know, which suggests that sometimes sexuality is holding and maintaining the sadism, and at other times, sexuality is in the service of a prior sadism, which is actually going. And he doesn't resolve that. In fact, he moves away from that thesis to then say, oh, Eros is about building bonds and Thanatos is about destructiveness and we can only hope Eros wins. So I have some questions about that. I actually think that neither Eros nor restraint are sufficient, but that new forms of sociality also have to be actively produced, but ones in which the ambivalence of love and the ambivalence of the tie and the co-presence of aggression and neurosis are all there. And I'm okay with the trans-ontological thing. I just want to know if it still permits for neurosis. I don't want to hear my mouth. And I would be worried if it was, I mean, my one worry about Spinoza is that I think he also skips over the death drag. You know? It gets a little, it's just a little too beautiful. But anyway, so that's what I said, sorry.
I think that is possible.
Yes?
Yeah.
Oh, good.
Well, I mean, this is where you see the limitations. I mean, the text on nostalgia is warming around for you. But your patients come to a place where they accept the contingencies of their history and what it's done to them, and the pleasures and pains and enjoyments that they can't escape and that they try to escape and often violently did harm to other people in the process, and it wasn't going to be any other way, but now they are going to live with their jouissance and find a way to ethically deploy in their lives. I mean, that's what I try to do, and it's possible.
Yeah, exactly. The problem is just our situation with the whole globe. Like, if we want to think big, how to transpose it socially.
Well, also, if you think about dismantling racism, right, or dismantling an unjust regime, there's destruction in that, and there is pleasure, right, and it is in the service of what we would understand to be justice. So, you know, we can have a little more about it.
On that note.